I'm Chris Sims, and this is the Canadian Taxpayers Podcast. We're dedicated to lower taxes, less waste, and more accountable government. In this episode, we have a special interview for you. We're not doing our usual deep dive and waste watch. We'll have those next time. For this episode, our Prairie Director Todd McKay speaks with Preston Manning. When he founded the Reform Party back in 1987, Mr. Manning declared, "The West wants in." Back then, many people in the prairies and in British Columbia felt alienated and unheard. They were tired of the spiraling debt, the hiked taxes, and the attacks on our resource industries. Sound familiar? In the years since, Mr. Manning has made a big impact on politics and public life in Canada, leading the Reform Party and the Canadian Alliance in the House of Commons in Ottawa, which eventually led to the creation of the Conservative Party of Canada. He has a brand new book out right now called Do Something, 365 Ways You Can Strengthen Canada. Todd spoke with Mr. Manning about his mission and his book. Here's their conversation.
All right, today I'm joined by Preston Manning. And of course, Mr. Manning was a founding leader of the Reform Party of Canada. He went on to found the Manning Center, and he's written a book called Do Something, 365 Ways You Can Strengthen Canada. Mr. Manning, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us today.
Glad to do it.
So I want to talk about some of the things in your book, some of the ideas there, but also some of the funny stories and interesting stories. You've had an interesting life in the game of public policy. In particular, you talked about a trip to China where you asked to meet with your counterpart. Could you tell us that story?
Well, yeah. By that time, I was leader of the opposition. I'd been to China a couple of times, and I'd got to know some of the officials in the what's called the International Liaison Department of the Communist Party. It's the foreign affairs department of the party, not the government. It's bigger than our foreign affairs. And I knew enough of these fellows to be able to kid with them a little bit. So when I got off the plane, they have this courtesy discussion. Is there anybody else you want to see? Is there any other place you want to go? And so I said, yeah, I would like to meet my equivalent. I would like to meet the leader of the official opposition in China. So this fellow that I put this to, he went away and huddled with his officials and came back. And he says, we think if there is such a person, he's in jail, or he should be. but then he got serious. He said, actually, the closest thing to you is that Mr. Martin Lee, who was the head of the Democratic Party in Hong Kong, which was not a bad answer. But that was the closest he could get to the leader of the opposition in China.
That's a funny story. We laugh about it. I think certainly you found it entertaining. But it's also, I bring it up because I think we often take a lot of this for granted. And I think of myself, my parents, they have a friend from Iran. And this gentleman was asking what I do for a living. My parents said, well, Todd makes fun of the government most of the time. That's kind of what he does. And this Iranian, his first question back to my parents was, is your son safe? Yeah, and this is something I never think about. I make fun of politicians on a very regular basis, but I don't worry about my safety. I think we often take this for granted, and we're often cynical that we can't make a difference in government. Where do you think that cynicism comes from? I think you're trying to solve that problem, but where do you think that cynicism comes from?
Well, I think a lot of Canadians, in fact, a lot of people in the Western world are disillusioned with the way our democracy is working. They increasingly mistrust elected people. They mistrust political parties. They mistrust democratic assemblies, legislatures, and the parliament. Partly, I think it's because they feel political people talk about issues, but nothing changes. So that's partly why I entitled my book "Do Something." I think that this is not just a concern in the political arena. I think there's an awful lot of people today who substitute discussion, talk, conferences, books, blogging, tweeting, whatever, but don't actually do something about the particular problem. And that's what I'm trying to encourage people to do. You started out on China. I think the thing we have to recognize is that we in the Western world are in a huge competition with China on this very issue. when my trips to China, I get into this in the book, the Chinese model, they have a model and they call it democracy, but it is state-directed democracy. And they say state-directed democracy is superior to your citizen-directed democracy. And they point to all the problems that we've got. And I think one of the big ideological contests of the 21st century is going to can we restore and revitalize citizen-directed democracy in competition with a country and a party that is arguing no state-directed governance is actually the superior model.
And that, of course, depends on us. And one of the things that I found interesting about your book is 365 ideas. You don't have to do all of them, but everybody can do some of them to actually do something. And one that jumped out at me is you point out that it's not advisable to rely on the media to get to know your elected representatives. Sometimes that portrayal isn't entirely accurate. And actually, I was thinking back to you specifically. I don't know if you remember the old show, Double Exposure, from the CBC. That's some of my first political memories, hearing them imitate you. But that's not who you are. That's not reality, nor is what you often see on the evening news in terms of the people that represent us. You suggest getting to know your elected representatives, meeting them at times. How important is that? And how do you go about doing that?
Well, I think it's very important. Well, maybe one other point first and then get on to that. Well, when I was a young fellow, my father was in politics all his life. He was Premier of Alberta for 25 years. And I came home one day denouncing some political person. And he said, how do you know that they're as bad as you say? Well, I've heard this and I've heard that. And I read this in the paper and I heard this on the talk show. Well, he said, look, you name five political people in Alberta, municipal people, provincial people, and I'll figure out some way for you to actually, if not meet them, get close to them. And I want you to write down what your current impression of them is. And then I want to arrange for you to actually meet them or get close to them at least. And then I want you to write down your impression, see if it's any different. And so we did this. And by golly, out of the five, three of them, my impression of them after I had got closer to them, or in one case met them, was different. And in fact, was more positive than the impression I'd had before. So I think this business of not just relying on what you know about the political people from the media, but trying to get close to them in one way or another is important. Now, ways of doing that, I mean, one simple way, political people do have meetings. And I know a lot of people don't get tired of that, but, you know, you can go to a meeting and you'll get a different impression by seeing the person in person as distinct from seeing them on television or and if you hang around long enough, you can actually meet them. If you're living in a particular constituency, a provincial constituency or a federal riding, you can go to the constituency office. Your MP or your MLA actually almost has a legal obligation to meet with you. So making those kind of efforts, I think, gives you a better feel of both the pluses and the minuses of people. And it's something you've ascertained yourself. You're not wholly dependent on a media person's interpretation.
You obviously spent a long time in politics yourself. I suspect you had a lot of interactions with your constituents, for better or worse, at times. Can you tell me about a time where a constituent had a real impact, what they had to say really impacted your thoughts on something?
Well, I tell you a couple of stories. One is just funny, but the other is actually answers your question. A lot of politicians' early contact with constituents often comes through door knocking, trying to get elected. So this is the first time he meets a constituent. And the first time I ran for the parliament under the reform banner was in the Yellowhead riding, where Joe Clark was the member. And I went out door knocking with a local fellow who's a very exuberant Westerner. And the very first door we knocked on, this lady said, "What's your position on the ozone layer?" Now, so I sat back and was trying to calculate a scientific answer. This fellow I was with says, "We're in favor of it, at least the western portion." I think we lost that vote. But often, like in some of our early work, we always had open question periods at our public meetings. And a woman, I remember her name to this day, this would be in Fort St. John, I think it was, in BC, got up in the question period, and because we were talking about fairness for the West, a fair deal for the West, subjects come up again. And she got up and she said, a number of years ago, a prominent federal politician came through here talking about a just society. And we thought he meant justice for everybody. And maybe in some sense he did. But it turned out that he really meant more fairness for the province he came from, which was Quebec. He was really talking about justice for Quebec because he thought Quebec had not got the right deal. Now, she says, when you talk about fairness, a fair deal for, are you just talking about fairness for one part of the country, our part of the country? Are you talking about fairness in the broadest sense? That's a very shrewd question. And I've always had this sort of faith. There is such a thing as the common sense of the common people. And you know, if you take time to get to know your constituents, they will share some of that common sense with you. Also, the language that they use. We got involved in the Charlottetown Accord referendum, an attempt to change the Constitution. And I had this great big long 45-minute speech on all the previous attempts to change the Constitution, which had failed, and that this one was going to fail too. But it was dull and boring. You just put people to sleep. And after one of these meetings, a fella came up to me. We were standing around with a little group, and he says, it's like we're like kids in the back of the car, he says, and we're trying to get to this place called national unity. And this guy says it's over here, and this guy says it's over there. So I reframed the whole talk. I started out with, we're like kids in the back of the car, and we're trying to get to this place called national unity. And Mr. Trudeau said it was over there, and we went over there, but it turned out to not be there. And then we let Joe Clark drive the car for a while, but he forgot to put gas in it, so we didn't go very far. And now somebody says it's over at this lake, this Meech Lake place. And now there's maybe it's Charlotte. And we're doing it in the back of the car saying, are we there yet? Are we there yet? René Lévesque says he's going to get sick if we don't let him out, so are we there yet? And I framed the whole constitutional discussion on the kids in the back of the car. But I got the idea, not from some PR outfit or advertising outfit, just an ordinary person trying to put into the way he would explain what I was saying to somebody else. So lots of common sense to common people if you take the time to dig it out.
And if those people take the time to give that to you, too, as a leader.
Oh, yeah, and you can pick it up anytime. In my writing, I ended up representing Calgary Southwest, and that was, there's a C train that goes through there, and I was riding on it the day I guess it was the 2001 election had been called. And I ended up sitting beside a fellow, and he's covered with sawdust. So I assumed he was a carpenter. And I always used to start conversations on the C train, and I'd get off and people would be arguing. And I said, you hear they called a federal election today? And the guy says, we heard that. We're talking about it at lunch. And I said, some of these people, the commentators say this sponsorship scandal is going to be a factor in this election. You heard about that? He said, yeah, well, a little bit, he said. And I said, well, what do you think about that? And he didn't answer for a while. By now, there's eight other people listening to this conversation. And he kind of looked at the ceiling, and he looked at his shoes. And then he said, you know, it's like there's something rotten in the fridge, he said. And we got to decide whether it's just the eggs or the cheese or whether we got to clean out the whole damn thing. that night I had to give a little talk on the election. And guess what analogy I used? Those types of analogies, the way your constituent would explain it to somebody else if he or she understood what you were saying, they are worth their weight in gold. And I think they make the difference between a politician that can actually communicate with real people as distinct from one that's flying off in some more academic or political speak. But to get there, you got to listen. You got to listen first and talk second.
Sure. I want to take that the link in the chain one step further. I think as constituents, we need to talk to our elected representatives more. I think you make that point numerous times in the book, and it's a well-taken point. But I think one of the frustrations people often have is that even if their MP listens to them, even if they're engaged with their local elected representative, once the party whips get involved and all of that kind of stuff, what kind of impact does it have? And one of the key points that you make often and have made for many years is there needs to be more free votes in the House of Commons and in legislatures. But is that something party leaders are ever going to do? Or is that something that MPs need to stand up like Jody Wilson-Raybould did and others have done at times and take that power themselves rather than waiting for leaders to give it to them?
Well, there's a better chance of getting that when there's a minority parliament or a minority legislature than when there's a majority. And what you have to do in arguing for free votes is really address what's called the confidence convention. This confidence convention is not part of the standing orders of the House of Commons. It's not in law, but it's a longstanding convention that if a government loses a motion in the elected parliament, even one as simple as the House adjourn at 5 o'clock, theoretically, it's obligated to resign. That this is the confidence move. And of course, leaders then use that, say, look, you disagree with us on this. Well, we understand that. But if you vote against us, if we lose this vote, you're all going to be out of a job. We're going to be in an election. And so I used to try to talk Cranchin into this. In fact, I wrote it out for him, said, get up and say this, that if the government loses a vote in this parliament, it will not resign, but it will immediately call for a confidence vote. It will ask, did you actually just mean to defeat this bill or this resolution, this motion, or did you actually mean to throw out the government? And if you had that understanding, of course, his own members could even vote against some government measure, but when the confidence motion came forward, of course, they'd all support the government. So you defeated this particular idea, or maybe a small thing, but you didn't throw the government out. And that one change, would, and then combined with allowing your members to have freer voting, would, I think, do a lot to make the parliament more sensitive to where public opinion is at, even when the public disagrees with the government. But it is very hard to persuade. Reform, we allowed our members free voting, and we had some rules around it. The main thing was you had to be able to demonstrate to us that it was your people and your constituents that wanted you to do this differently, not just your own. And we specified that. Finding out what your constituents meant didn't mean just going back on the weekend, talking to your brother-in-law and your sister and your cousin, coming back and saying, my people want me to do something. But the times that we did exercise, our members exercised that free vote, guess what the headline was in the Ottawa papers? It wasn't free voting. It was reform divided because some of us voted this way and some voted that way, which ended up being very punishing politically too, because it made it look like we were all over the map.
I've got more policy questions, but you brought up Jean Chrétien and you went head to head with him for a lot of years. It's easy to pit political opponents as just enemies. They hate each other, whatever.
Yeah.
But both of you seem pretty comical. Do you have any funny Jean Chrétien stories?
Oh yeah, a couple of them. The first time I went to meet him, I might have met him once before, but the first time I went as the leader of the Reform Party, we were the third party. He always called us the third party, which didn't go over well with us. But anyway, I went to see him, and he starts out like he's quite a social guy, and he uses his social interest to deflect you from anything substantial. So the first thing he says, how's your mother and how's your father? He knew my parents. And then he always claimed he had a cousin in St. Paul, Alberta, which is there's a French-speaking community there. How's my cousin in St. Paul? And he would have gone on, and the first time he did, he went on for 15, 20 minutes like that. I only had a half an hour with him, but he's the prime minister, so I'm a little reluctant to say, look, you know, I came here to talk about something else. But he would have taken up the entire half hour with that kind of talk. So the next time I went in there, I always had a list when I went in to the CEO. Next time I went in there, he started this again. How's your mother? How's your father? How's my cousin in St. Paul? I said, look, I'll talk about that for 3 minutes, but I came here to talk about this, this, and this. And he rolled his eyes and said, okay. The other thing, like, I, you know, this is just personal opinion. Jiang Kai-shek was not an eloquent speaker in either official language, but he was a storyteller. In fact, that was where he was most effective. And I remember going to an event the Canada Post put on. They put out a series of postage stamps with some of the former premiers, and one of them was my father, and they had this sort of ceremony. But it was typical bureaucrat organized. It was dull and everything. But Kretchen was there and was asked to say a few words, and so he threw away whatever script they'd given him because he knew almost every one of these previews that were being, and he just started to tell stories about each one, and it was very effective and very entertaining. But we had a few encounters both like that and of course in the house.
I suspect you did. I actually worked at the St. Paul Journal back in the day, and I never met any of Kretchen's cousins, or at least none of them admitted to knowing them. So. We can fact check that later.
Yes, yes, yeah, yeah.
To get back to the policy things in your book, Do Something, you talk about more referendums. And I think we're seeing more push for that. But opponents of them often say they're messy. They point to things like the Quebec referendum, which were divisive. Brexit, obviously, very controversial. Tell us the upsides. Give us examples of the upsides on referendums and why you think they're important.
Well, I've never advocated that you have a referendum every second day, but I do think there are some big issues where the public ought to have the final say. And particularly if you're going to fundamentally alter your constitution, which is what the coping with the Quebec secession attempt would have involved. I think that was one of such cases. And Canada's not exactly overdosed on national referendum. We've had 3, 4, maybe 5. One of the things I like about referendum campaigns is their educational value. But the political people have to be careful in how you do that. You got to allow a fair amount of time and use that referendum time to educate people on what the issue is and what the alternatives are. And I think that's one of their main values is their educational value. But it takes time because initially a whole bunch of people are completely disinterested in it, and it'll take time to get them interested. But that educational value, I think, is one of the virtues of referenda.
Yeah, it does force a conversation as opposed to ignoring problems. Which actually leads right into my next question about equalization. And Premier Kenney has committed to having a referendum on equalization. We're very hopeful that that would prompt an in-depth conversation about it. So let me put you on the spot. How do we fix equalization?
Well, for one thing, it's not easy because the principle is enshrined in the Constitution, not how you do it, just the principle. So people that imply that the formula and everything else is constitutional. No, it isn't. There's just a commitment to the concept. The part of the difficulty of doing anything is if you want to amend even the concept in the Constitution, that's a fundamental constitutional amendment that requires the consent of 7 provinces with more than 60% of the population plus the consent of the federal parliament. And the chance of getting that, particularly when you've got 7, 8, 9 provinces that are benefiting from equalization just the way it is, how are you going to ever persuade them to even open that up? I do think a couple of things that referendum in Alberta will do. One is it will show that there's a large number of people, particularly in Alberta and in Saskatchewan, that feel that is unfair. And you know, you get a few million people saying, we think this is unfair. It's got to attract some attention. There are some smaller things you can do. In fact, this Fair Deal report that just came out in Alberta refers to this. There's a thing connected to equalization called the Fiscal Stabilization Fund. And what it was meant for was if there was some problems, it was contributing and contributing and contributing way more than it ever benefited, and it got into trouble, there would be a possibility of a repayment back to that problem. But unfortunately, that stabilization fund was capped, and it was capped in such a way, if the cap was removed, Alberta would be eligible for about a $2.4 billion equalization repayment back to Alberta. But so you could fix the fiscal stabilization fund, and would be one tiny step towards greater fairness. Yeah, I mean, I know you like stories, and like equalization is only part of a bigger picture. It's called federal provincial transfers. There's all kinds of ways the federal government can give money to one part of the country and not to the other. Equalization is one of them, but there's a whole bunch. Any program they set up, they can. You've seen what Mr. Trudeau's doing with his response to COVID-19, you know, somebody howls over here and a pile of money goes there. It doesn't go to the rest of the country. And my father, he became premier in 1943 during the war. So he knew Mackenzie King, Louis Saint Laurent, John Diefenbaker, Lester Pearson, and the front end of Pierre Trudeau. And he went to the first federal provincial conference after the war, where equalization was the first time equalization, I don't think they even called it that, was talked about. And I asked him about that one time, because I was going to university, and the professor, the University of Alberta, gave a very learned lecture on the intellectual properties of the equalization formula and the principles on which it was based. I went across the river to the Alberta legislature. I said to my father, I understand equalization. Oh, he says, oh, that's good. Tell me how it works. I got halfway into this, and he starts to laugh. I said, well, what are you laughing about? He says, I went to the conference, after the first one after the war, where this was talked about. And it was a typical federal provincial conference. We all sat around the table. Mackenzie King was at the head of it, and we couldn't agree on anything. So that night, at the typical of the federal provincial conferences, they went to the prime minister's house for the private dinner. This was Kingsmere, outside of Ottawa, where the wine was liberally distributed to lubricate the premier. My father was a teetotaler, so he kept his head. And the discussion got into concreteness. You know, King was, what do you got to get? What do you want? What do you want? What are you prepared to give up to give him what he wants? And this is actually the deal model of Confederation. The premiers and the prime minister get together. They each got some cards. Here's what I want. Here's what I'm prepared to give up. And the skill of being the prime minister in a federation is managing to get a deal out of that. And my father said what he thought happened the next day is the King hauled in his chief secretary or the finance minister and the deputy minister of finance, said, figure out some way to get him 30 million, him 40 million, him 10 million, and then figure out some kind of explanation, a rationalization for what we're doing. And I do think there's an awful lot of politics in federal provincial transfers. Equalization is one part of it that is more fixed, but there's an awful lot of room for more fairness if that was the primary commitment. Particularly the primary commitment of the prime minister.
And we have to have conversations.
Long explanation.
There are no short explanations about equalization. That question right there, Chrétien could have used up your whole meeting talking about that anytime. I want to take another one. In your book, Do Something, you also, of course, talk about Senate reform and things that could be done to make that better. I think a lot of people are starting to give up on that. Stephen Harper was in power and wasn't able to really push through Senate reforms. Is it time to give up and abolish the Senate, or do you still have hope that it could be reformed?
Well, I think it could be reformed. To be fair to Harper, he actually got a bill, but it got stalled in the courts, and what the Supreme Court said, even the changes, he argued that some changes could be made without a constitutional amendment. At least you could democratize the place. But the Supreme Court ruled, no, it had to come under the formula. You got to get seven provinces with two-thirds of the population. And of course, under what we were talking about, the Atlantic provinces and Quebec and Ontario would lose Senate seats. So it was just a non starter. But I do think you can democratize. I do think you could democratize the place. I mean, Alberta had the Senate Selection Act, where candidates for the Senate were, the names would be put before the electors, and then those names would be put to the Prime Minister for appointment. So he still appoints them, which is within the law. But the names that he is given to appoint have a democratic mandate. I do think that you could still push that. And then maybe eventually, if the Senate is more actually democratic, actually accountable to somebody, you might be able to push some of the other reforms. But it's been a very hard struggle. One of the lessons from what reform did, and this is the thing I talked to even opposition MPs, when we advocated something like Senate reform, we didn't just give speeches, write books about it. In those days, you couldn't blog or tweet about it, but we would. We actually drafted a Senate reform bill. In fact, Mel Smith, who was a deputy attorney general of British Columbia, was sympathetic to us. Mel, I don't know whether this came within his job description or not, but he helped draft the bill. And so when we talked about it, it wasn't just talk. We said, well, look, we got an act here, a bill. And I've said this to some of the younger MPs today. A lot of them, because they're in the sort of interest group mentality, think they've done something by speechifying on an idea, say you don't agree with the ban on West Coast tanker traffic. So they make speeches about it and they blog about it and they tweet about it and say, no, draft an amendment to the legislation that banned that. You're legislators. You're not just talkers and representatives. You're lawmakers. So, and of course it won't get through the parliament, but carry it that one step farther because you're the only ones that can do it. Or draft a bill applying the West Coast tanker ban to the East Coast and make the government vote against it and give the reasons why they vote against it. To take these ideas, if you're a parliamentarian, take them one step forward into draft laws, not just speeches. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. You definitely have to take it a step further sometimes. Talking isn't the same as doing. You definitely learn that on the farm at times. And it's applicable to politics too, I think. A lot of your book talks about, provides advice for people who are considering running for office. We need good people to run for office. I'm going to make fun of them. I got to be honest about that. That's what we do at the Taxpayers Federation a lot of times. But we do need good people to run for office, and you provide a lot of advice for it. But again, I'd like to draw on your personal experience, because for a lot of people in politics, it's hard for them. They have bad days, but often those bad days are even tougher on the family. And you're second generation in politics. I was wondering if you could talk about perhaps one of the tough days that your father had when he was premier, and how he got through that, and what that was like for you and for your family.
Well, it's hard for me to actually identify that, because if you grow up in a political family, you get used to this, just the constant attack. And I guess there's two ways you can react to it. You can let that get to you, or you can just build a shell around yourself where it doesn't matter. My brother and I, when we were young, the folks used to have a housekeeper or a nanny that would look, they had a lot of public things to do. They had this one housekeeper who thought us reading in the paper all the abuse father was getting, particularly when the legislation was sitting, was not good for our development. So she undertook to cut out of the paper all the abusive stuff. And when the legislation was sitting, the paper looked like a piece of spaghetti that she could.
Nothing but strips left.
So I guess my way of coping with it, even at a young age, was basically to ignore it. Now the one danger of that is that you build up a shell around yourself, that when there are certain messages, particularly ones with an emotional content that ought to get through to you, they don't get through either. And so political people that take that route have to be careful that they don't become impervious to every emotion, every statement or thing that's got emotion connected to it. And like I did learn some things at a fairly young age. My parents had a farm outside the city. My dad was raised on a farm. I always thought you had to have land. So we had this dairy farm. He was premier 5 days a week. He worked on the farm on Saturday. And then he had this religious radio program that Eberhard had started. And he carried on Sunday. His idea, he had no idea of recreation. It was just change the work you were doing. But when we moved out to the farm, I was still going to an elementary school in Edmonton. And I used to go across the river. It was just Garneau School, just across the river from the legislature. And on cabinet days, I'd go across there. And the cabinet used to they'd have their cabinet meeting. And then they went to a cafeteria in one of the public buildings. And they had a separate room there where it often carried on. And I would actually go along with them. And I actually sat in on, I learned quite a bit, because they would carry on what they were talking about. But in this cafeteria, there was the man that ran it was a Mr. Schultz. And every time I went through the line behind my father, between three cabinet ministers, Mr. Schultz would put a big donut on a plate and put a big scoop of ice cream on it, which I was very appreciative. And one day, one of my father's secretaries said to me, "Do you know why Mr. Schultz does that?" Well, I said, "You know, he's a nice guy. He thinks I'm a nice kid." He said, "No, Mr. Schultz knows that the contract for that restaurant is your father will have something to do with whether it's renewed or not. So like these people that are kind and treating you special, maybe it's genuine, but a lot of it isn't." And you know, for a 12-year-old kid, that's a bit of a lesson in reality, and a bit of a setback too.
Yeah, that would be a tough part when even kindness is suspect, I suppose.
Yeah.
Obviously, though, it's funny. I think many of us have a negative view of elected life because of Twitter, because of those negative media scrums. You spent basically a lifetime in it. What was your best day in elected life?
Oh, well, a couple of them. I think the first night that Reform had, we had won, our first member was Deborah Gray, who won in a by-election. And then in 1993, we actually got our 52 seats. And that was a very special night, not just because of winning the election, but because for me, it vindicated the idea that a small group of people could take the tools that democracy gives to everybody, freedom of speech, freedom of association, freedom to try to persuade you to do this instead of that. And notwithstanding all the flaws in our democratic system, a small group of people were able to do that and get a foothold in the parliament again. And then and I would argue that then went on to create the Canadian Alliance, which then founded the foundations of the Conservative Party of Canada, which then created a minority government, then had a majority government. A very small group of people, five of us actually met at the first meeting in a room in Calgary. And the fact that a small group could still influence, you know, not get everything we wanted by any chance, but at least influence the system. That I found that very encouraging, and I found that night very vindicating. And the same was when the Charlottetown Accord referendum was first announced. The pollster said that 65 to 70% of the public are in favor, because every premier and the prime minister said it's the greatest thing since sliced bread. Well, some of us said we don't think so, and we're going to change that. Golly, by the end of that campaign, and not just what we did, Pierre Trudeau got involved, and Clyde Wells and a bunch of other people, but we were able to turn what was supposed to be 65 to slightly over 50% against. And again, to me, it wasn't just winning our point. It was that despite all the flaws in the democratic system, and I've been critical of them, and I think this is something that Canada has and Canadians should appreciate. I don't know how you would start to do that in the United States today. It's too big, it's too polarized. But in Canada, you still can. Small group can have a positive influence if they take the tools that democracy gives them and do something with them.
Well, maybe my next question just really expands on that. Your book, Do Something, 365 Ways to Make Canada Better. There's a sense of hope in that. And a lot of people aren't hopeful, particularly in parts of the country. You're hopeful about Canada. Tell me more about that sense of hope.
Well, we have some strengths that I don't think we leave her, and I don't think the current government even acknowledges. We're the second largest country on mass, which means we've got the second largest store of natural resources in the world, in the globe. with a relatively small population. Like our wealth per capita, if you could translate the resources into dollars, is immense, and it should be something that people are proud of, and it's a foundation for an economy. I see the resource sectors as foundational to the economy, and it's not just to take the energy sector. Yes, there's the energy producing sector, which gets all the attention, but there's an energy manufacturing sector, which is huge. There's an energy service sector, which is huge. There's an energy knowledge sector, which is huge. When you do that with forestry and agriculture and fishery and mining, the whole economy, in my view, rests on that natural resource foundation. This country is bountifully equipped with that resource. And that gives me some aspiration, or gives me some hope. And then what we started out on, there's a lot of nonsense through the social media and negativity and all that, but there is this common sense to the common people too. It's out there. It doesn't get much expression. It's not newsworthy. The common sense to common people is not newsworthy, but it's out there, and it's a resource. And in a democracy, it's a resource that has to be called upon. So I think that we have resources in our people. We have natural resources that should be the envy of the world. And yes, there's all kinds of problems, but I'm optimistic that those resources can be drawn upon.
So this is just kind of a bonus question, and it's one that mostly I'm just curious about. You reference history throughout your book, and I enjoy history a lot because it reminds us that there have been big problems in different places and different times that we've had to address. It's not like we're the first ones coming up against challenges. And in your book, Do Something, you reference a very famous politician, Abraham Lincoln, and talk about him. But you also reference a name that probably a lot of people wouldn't recognize, William Wilberforce.
Yes.
And here's my question for you, and I hope it's fun for you as a history person like myself. Who is the more successful politician, Lincoln or Wilberforce?
Oh, boy. Yeah, that's hard to answer. What you've raised here is very fundamental to this democratic business. The issue was the abolition of slavery, and it's a moral issue, and it's an ethical issue, as well as an economic one, which are always the hardest ones to deal with because people are passionate about. The more moralistic or ethical an issue is, the more they can't just trade off their views and find a compromise. Now, the British model of how to deal with it was led by Wilberforce. And in a way, a small group, 12 guys, met in a printer shop in London and decided they were going to go after it, basically by democratic means. They were going to change the mind of the parliament on that issue. They were going to get enough public support that the politicians couldn't do anything else. And after 50 years, they did manage to do it by basically using the tools that democracy gives to everybody. The bill that abolished slavery in the British Parliament did not get through until a reform bill got through, which broadened the franchise and made the House of Commons the real chamber, not the House of Lords, which was opposed to the change. Now, Lincoln, on the American, on the other hand, and to be fair to them, there was 30-year struggle prior to the Civil War, every conceivable attempt to try to fix that problem without violence, but they all failed. And in the end, the U.S. abolished slavery. It took a war that killed a million of their own people, just the most terrible thing that can happen to a federal state to come apart like that. And Lincoln was not a war monger. I mean, he even in justifying the war, he never used the so-called just war argument that what we're doing is right and using violence is the right thing to do. He said war was evil. It just happened to be a lesser evil than the perpetuation of slavery or the dividing of the United States. So I'd say Wilberforce used the democracy tools to solve that problem. And so he was the more successful Democrat. Lincoln went to solve the problem, but he had to use undemocratic means to do it, which he himself probably regretted, but would say he had no other choice. So there's a nice political answer for you. They're both great guys.
It's a good one, though. And but it's a good reminder that big things can be done and they can be done different ways. And so I appreciate you indulging me in answering that question as well. Well, thank you so much. I don't want to take too much of your time. I know you're trying to get back to the farm in Saskatchewan. I never want to delay people doing that. But thank you for writing your book, Do Something, 365 Ideas. There's something in there for absolutely everybody to do to make Canada better. And I want to thank you for writing that. And thank you for joining us today.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to the Canadian Taxpayers Podcast. Please remember to subscribe to the show so you don't miss an episode. And if you have a friend who you know would like this podcast, could you please let them know and share it with them? You can send us an email and find all of our past episodes on our website, taxpayer.com.